The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Now, today, of course, marks the 1 year anniversary of the October 7th attacks when a Hamas led militant groups led incursions into southern Israel. And it was the catalyst, of course, to a year of absolute devastation in Gaza and beyond. Two people who are no strangers to the issues facing all of the communities in that part of the world. Joining me now, Aziz Abu Sara, who's a Palestinian peace activist and journalist, and Danielle Bett, who's an Israeli working with a pro-peace movement as well. You're both very, very welcome to the show, and thank you for taking the time to speak to us. Danielle, can I start with you? Because I think you were in Tel Aviv this day last year, is that right?
Yeah, I was in Tel Aviv on October 7th, 2023. So like most Israelis, was woken up by the sound of sirens and explosions on that morning. And then from then on, things kind of have just gotten worse and worse.
And talk me through then maybe your experience of kind of realization of that day, of the scale of what had happened or what was happening.
Well, to be honest, usually in central Israel, it's a safer area to be. And so if there are sirens and rockets, there's a heads up of some sort or an indication that it's going to happen. So it was quite unexpected, so much so that we thought that it was maybe a mistake in the system. And then we started to get more messages and indications from the south that something horrific was happening. Someone in my neighborhood group chat wrote that they're at a party and they're being shot at. And then we saw more footage from towns in the north of on the south of Israel with Hamas terrorists inside of them. And then again, we had rocket rounds in the days and weeks following that as well. So we didn't immediately realize the scale of what was happening. It was pretty unimaginable. I think everything we thought about security and managing the conflict has pretty much crumbled since then.
And how quickly did you realize, or did you start to think about, oh God, what's going to happen next? What is this going to precipitate?
I mean, very quickly, half of my friends are IDF reservists and they got very quick calls to go to the south. And so we knew that a big response was expected, but it was very unclear as to what it was going to look like and what we were facing. But especially taking into account this particular Israeli government, which is a far right government, the most far right government in Israel's history, we knew that we were going to enter into a bloody and long conflict. And the biggest concern was obviously that over 250 Israeli hostages were taken. And to many of us, the priority is getting them home, but 101 of them still remain in Gaza.
How kind of live a conversation is that in Israel still a year onwards? Because it's kind of, it's remarkable how forgotten that has become with everything else that's happened in other parts of the world.
Yeah, I mean, with the rise in the violence in the north with Hezbollah and subsequently the people of Lebanon, it's become less of a headline. But for the Israeli public, most Israelis are for months now have said that they want a ceasefire if it means releasing all hostages. I think it's very clear that this government hasn't prioritized the release of all hostages and that they don't have a direction for how to end this terrible war in Gaza. So Israelis continue to fight for the release of hostages. There are weekly protests, if not daily protests, across the country calling for the government to end this and to release the hostages that remain, because we know that they're living on borrowed time.
And Aziz, can you talk me through then your experience of October 7th and of kind of learning what was happening as it unfolded, and then the kind of the days and weeks afterwards?
Yeah, I got a call from my colleague Kim, whose friend was taken captive on October 7th, and then in the next few days I was talking to just different Israeli friends who've directly been affected. Maoz Inon, who's lost his parents, Yonatan, whose mother, Vivian, was killed, Vivian Silver, who was a friend of mine. I didn't talk to Yonatan for a while after, but I was following the news of Vivian Silver because she was a very dear friend. My other friend, Udi, whose cousin was killed. So I was you know, I'm very connected as a peace activist to the Israeli society. And so I knew many people who are directly impacted. And I knew right away that, just like Danielle said, that the response from Israel will be brutal. And in the next few days after, I started hearing from my Palestinian friends in Gaza who were losing many people in their families. My friend Abdelrahim lost 50 people in his family in Gaza in an airstrike that hit their building, and the whole family was sheltering together. My friend Ahmad lost 60 people in his family. And those are became common stories. I just spent some time with a friend who served as a doctor in Gaza recently, and the stories I've heard, you know, we're hearing about people being killed from the airstrikes, but even more people are being killed because of lack of medicine, lack of antibiotics. And he's saying, you're looking at a child and you know you can save him. All you need is just simple antibiotics and you don't have it. And that kid is condemned to death. And that has become a reality of life. If you have a chronic illness, you are going to die. If you have diabetes, you are going to die. You have cancer, you are going to die. That became the reality of life in Gaza after October 7th. And it's unbearable. It's unbearable to witness all these things, unbearable to think this is a reality that has become a norm. You know, It's not just 2 weeks, not just 3 months. It's been a year and we don't see an end in sight.
One of the narratives that emerged early, and again, so much has happened, you kind of forget about some of it, but was that this would kind of ultimately blow back in the face of kind of Netanyahu and the Israeli government, because what they were kind of doing was maybe kind of creating the the kind of frontline Hamas militants of the future, and I'm just interested in asking you about that, Aziz, because you know, my understanding is your brother, when he was killed, you would have gone through a period whereby you were probably filled with a degree of vengeance, and right. You went on a personal journey out of that. So maybe you could tell me about that.
Yeah, when my brother was killed, I was 10 years old. So I felt my only choice is my brother was killed through being beaten up in Israeli prison, which sadly, it's something we see happening still today in Israeli prisons. I was very angry. I wanted revenge. For the next 8 years, that was the only thing I focused on. Between age 10 and 18, there was nothing else more important for me than revenge. But I realized when I was 18 that every time you choose to hate, you are being a slave to the person, in my case, to the person who killed my brother. Every time I chose revenge, I was being a slave to that person because they made the decision for me instead of me making my own decisions. And that was such a redeeming thing, taking agency back and saying, I make my own choices. But the other thing that I found to be important was that I found partners, I found allies in Israel who me and them didn't have disagreements. They didn't have disagreements in the sense and the values, the value of equality, of justice, of recognition, of safety for everyone. Those are things that we agree on, and realize that the division should never be Israelis versus Palestinians, Jews versus Muslims, all these kind of nationality, ethnicity, religious divisions, but rather the division is between those of us who believe in equality, in justice, in peace, and those who don't yet. And our mission is to convince the rest of those around us to join us. I was one of those. My family were one of those. So I understand some people need the time, but it's our mission to make that happen. And when I look at politicians today, they are on the ones who are not on the same side as us. Danielle and I are on the same side. Definitely Sinwar and Netanyahu are not on our side. And that's, we don't see each other here as opposite sides being talking to you now. We are coming together for the same purpose, saying every life is valuable. Whether the child is Israeli or Palestinian child, it really makes no difference to me. They are equal in the value of life. And the moment we start thinking, I need to know the nationality and the religion and the ethnicity of a person before of a child even, before I decide if I'm going to feel empathy or not, That's very dangerous, and that means we lost any connection to our humanity.
Danielle, how kind of Sisyphean does all of this work feel at the moment? Or do you get a sense of progress in calls for peace?
Listen, I think especially at the beginning of the war, it was very difficult because so many people were so shaken and afraid, and so many people are traumatized and afraid, and Israel and in Palestine. And so there's a lot of distrust and there's a complete and utter lack of leadership. And I think that the onus isn't just on civilians to believe in peace, but to have leaders that will take them there and show them that there is a better future rather than divide us and prove to one another that we're all enemies. And so it is difficult. But at the same time, I think that we have reached a worst case scenario that we could have never imagined. We now have a war on so many fronts, it's difficult to count because it changes every day, whether it be with Iran or Hezbollah in the north or the Houthis in Yemen. And so actually we have to ask ourselves, what are the long-term resolutions? Because this cannot continue. This is not a livable situation for the people in the Middle East, for the average ordinary civilians who simply want to live in security and safety. And we can argue about borders and we can argue about exactitudes of religious sites and so on and so forth. But the key thing is to bring people around the table. And I think that enough people have reached a point where we're saying this isn't a livable situation anymore. But there is a job for leaders and for peace activists to create that hope and that to demonstrate that solidarity is possible and change is possible.
And Aziz, I was reading a piece in The Independent of the UK that you were quoted in which you cited kind of examples of other peace processes, including Northern Ireland.
Yes, I think Northern Ireland is an incredible example. I'm actually working with a group of Israelis and Palestinians on a documentary to show what can we learn from the peace agreement in Northern Ireland. Look, in 1993, if you went anywhere in the world and said, which has more likelihood of being solved, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Northern Ireland conflict, most people say Israel and Palestine. There was the Oslo Accord being signed and so on. While Northern Ireland looked, it's impossible. People would say, oh, it's hundreds of years old. There's no future. There's no possibility. Today, we are celebrating over, or, well, not today, but in this time, we're celebrating over 25 years of Northern Ireland peace agreement. And Israel and Palestine is in a place where no one expected in the 90s that we will be at. So I look at Northern Ireland and I see so much hope. I've met with people who were, militants, people who were terrorists, people who wanted to kill the other side, so no other solution. And they have come back from that and they have changed their past. So the idea that you cannot talk to your enemy is absurd. You only, peace is about talking to your enemy. If we are friends, then it's all working out. So obviously there are some hard moments. And by the way, even after the peace agreement was signed in Northern Ireland, there were terror attacks after. Actually, the worst terror attacks happened after. And people were smart enough to say, we will not let any attack take us back to an endless war, an endless conflict. And I've met people who said, look, I met a guy who said, I lost my wife and I see the person who killed my wife out in the streets and it pains me. It's very hard because part of the agreement, he had to be released. But what's the alternative? The alternative is making sure my daughter would not have a safe life. And so I'm willing to let go of my anger to give my daughter a chance to live. So there's so much we can learn from Northern Ireland. There's so much we can learn from many other conflicts, even Israel and Palestine itself. The peace agreement with Egypt, between Israel and Egypt. No one believed it would happen after the darkest, most brutal war in 1973. It took only 5 years after to have a signed agreement in which Israel gave back the land it occupied. And that agreement has made Israel and Egypt allies. So when Israelis often, when Netanyahu, I would say, keeps talking about, oh no, peace is not possible in this generation. Are you kidding me? It took 5 years after the hardest war in Israel and then you have a safe border for the last 50 years, and he's saying can't happen in this generation. Are we really willing to sacrifice another generation and another generation? It's our obligation, more than do we have hope or not. It's an obligation that we continue to work day and day, night and night, to make sure that it is this generation that solves this conflict. Don't kick it to another generation. Let's not waste so many more lives.
And Daniel, if I can finish up with you, what's your expectation as to what happens in the short term?
I think, unfortunately, in the short term, I'm kind of lacking in hope. But in the long term, I feel that there is hope and there is potential for change, because we do have a situation where we are led by extremists and we are led by people who don't want to see an end to this conflict, who don't have a long-term plan, who in Israel, the leadership isn't showing any willingness to prioritize even Israeli hostages, let alone the lives of Palestinians in Gaza. But I think that if you watch what's been happening in Israeli society as well as in Palestinian society, because most Palestinians in Gaza do not support Hamas and are not represented by Hamas, I think if you watch the people on the ground, we are the hope and we are the people who are going to make the change, because throughout this war, hundreds of thousands of Israelis have been marching on the streets, calling for a ceasefire, calling for a return of all hostages, and saying we want this to end. And I think that whilst the government may not have caved to that pressure because it's only interested in its own political survival, ultimately, we will have elections again, hopefully, and that those elections can cause a shift. And also, we can see the international community is getting fed up with this endless war, because no one in the region wants this to continue to expand. There are partners in the region. And so I think that there is hope, but there is a lot of work to be done. It's not something that's going to happen just because we hope for it, but because we work to create that change. And so I will continue to be one of the thousands protesting and being a voice for change. And I'm grateful for people like Aziz and allies in Palestine who are doing the same.
Danielle and Aziz, thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you, Karen.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.